welcome. Good to see you here. On this rather adjusted date, we've had a few challenges trying to get this presentation, and we didn't want to lose the opportunity, so I'm really grateful to the Globe for allowing us the opportunity to use this place as a venue. We're in the 176th year of the New Zealand Army, and last year you would have been aware that we wanted to commemorate the 175th anniversary, but of course COVID hit. And so on the 24th of March this year, they managed to hold a parade in Wellington commemorating the 175th, or the end of the 175 years. And then, of course, we went into various stages of lockdown again. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to Colonel Ian Brandon, who's the commanding officer of the 2nd Engineer Regiment out at Linton Camp, who is also a keen military historian, aren't you, Ian?
Very, very much an amateur.
But Ian's going to talk to us a little bit about the foundations of the New Zealand Army, particularly in those earlier years running up to World War I. So without further ado, welcome Ian.
Cool, thanks, James. Well, kia ora, your worship, ladies and gentlemen. It's a privilege to be here today to talk to you all a little bit about the foundations of the New Zealand Army. A little bit about me. So, as Joe said, I'm in the Corps of Royal New Zealand Engineers. I'm just coming to the end of my 2.5 years commanding 2nd Engineer Regiment. I've been in the service for about 20 years now, and during that time have filled the normal kind of variety of regimental training and staff appointments, and my operational service has been in Afghanistan, Iraq and Sinai. I am very much an amateur, an enthusiastic amateur when it comes to military history, so please be kind with your questions. But hopefully what I can offer is a little bit of perspective and insight as somebody who has served in our army for 20 years, particularly about what this early history continues to mean to our army today. So the scope of what I'm going to talk about, I very quickly realised when I was preparing this presentation that it would not be possible to do any sort of justice to the full 175-year history of our army, even in overview. So what I've chosen to do is focus on the first 80 years or so, which I see as having formed the foundation of everything that has followed. We're going to begin by taking a look at the period 1845 to 1899, which covers the formation of the army and its operations in New Zealand. After that, I'll talk about the Imperial Wars that New Zealand was involved in from 1899 through to 1918, and then wrap up with some conclusions about the relevance of this early history to our army today. So, the first period, formation and operations in New Zealand. So I'll just say the image up on the screen there is of a private in the New Zealand militia that was taken in the 1860s. You can see he's wearing typical campaign dress, the dark blue pork pie forage cap, blue shirt and trousers with leather equipment, and he's armed with an Enfield pattern rifle musket fitted with bayonet. So, the militia. The official birthday of our army was the 25th of March 1845, and that was when the Legislative Council passed the first militia ordinance in response to concern about Honohiki's operations in the Auckland region. Subsequent to that, there was a Militia Act that was passed in mid-1858 by the New Zealand Parliament, and that divided the country up into militia districts with a permanent training staff in each. So that first ordinance that was passed in 1845 provided for all able-bodied men between the ages of 18 and 65 to hold themselves in readiness for service and for a period of 28 days annual training. It was essentially a home force, so their service was limited to within 40 kilometres of their local police station. The governor of the colony, who was Robert Fitzroy at the time, was empowered to call out that militia for service. A small detachment of volunteers from the Auckland Militia Battalion served as pioneers and gunners alongside regular British forces in engagements against Honohiki at Kororarika, Okaiho and Ohiawe in mid-1845. The Militia Act that was passed in 1858 contained many of the same provisions as that original ordinance. It also allowed militiamen to find substitutes for their service at their own expense, and it made provision for the formation of volunteer units whose members were exempted from militia service, but who could be required to serve anywhere in New Zealand. And I've just got a photograph here, it's a little bit grainy, apologies for that, of one of those militia units from Whanganui in the 1860s. So I want to take a couple of minutes at this point to talk about Ngāti Tumātauinga. So while the official birthday of our army is 1845, our culture actually runs much deeper than that and integrates aspects of both Māori and European military heritage. The Māori people became our tangata whenua hundreds of years before the arrival of Europeans, and by the time of first contact had developed a very unique approach to warfighting. Warfare was an important part of Māori life. Iwi and hapu groups took a very deliberate approach to campaigning against one another to secure resources, territory, or in the pursuit of utu. Toa were trained to be expert in hand-to-hand fighting, most notably using the taiaha, patu, meri, pōwhenua, and tefatefa. These were eventually supplemented with the short and long-handled tomahawk. The arrival of firearms completely changed the face of warfare for the Māori, upsetting the delicate balance of power between the various iwi and resulting in widespread conflict pre-1840, now referred to as the Musket Wars. The Māori were very adept at using ground and cover to their advantage, very, very good at operating in difficult forested terrain. But they also made extensive use of waterways, using these great war canoes, these waka, to transport their toa, their war parties, along rivers or across bays and estuaries. They were also practitioners of amphibious warfare, and one example I'll draw your attention to was the Battle for Kapi Island in 1824. The Battle of Wairua, as it is known, was fought between Ngāti Toa, led by Taropraha, and a conglomeration of North and South Island iwi. Taropraha rates as one of New Zealand's great military leaders, one of many, in fact, from this period and the subsequent land wars. He'd captured Kapiti Island the year prior, following the long Ngāti Toa migration south from Kawhia, a result of the Musket Wars. So this huge assembly of allied iwi concentrated on the Horowhenua coast, hundreds if not thousands of warriors, and a large number of these great waka, what a sight that must have been. However, the allies could not decide on one plan to attack the island and to offset Taropraha's advantage with muskets, and so one iwi decided on a night attack, with the remainder opting for dawn. Kapiti would be an extremely difficult location to attack. Even assuming permissive sea conditions, there are very limited places where a waka can be landed. The beaches are steep and pebbled. Wairua is an inlet at the northeast end of the island, where Ngāti Toa had sighted one of their defensive pā. While they were initially caught off guard, Taropraha was quickly able to gain the initiative and concentrate his defending forces on the landing sites. This, and the lack of cohesion between attacking iwi, led to slaughter, with at least 170 toa killed on the beaches. So this battle actually also had strategic consequences. It was a decisive victory for Taropraha, but it also yielded this enormous fleet of waka that him and his allies were then able to use to invade the South Island, eventually attacking as far south as Akaroa. So So the Māori were also experts at the development of defensive warfare, and this is shown in how their pā systems evolved during the course of the land wars. So historically, Māori pā were constructed to dominate terrain features, often tiered, as shown in the picture there, and with observation platforms. This suited combat that was dominated by hand-to-hand weapons, but quickly became obsolete in the face of muskets and cannons. The Māori, however, displayed an extraordinary ability to assess the impacts of these weapons and adapt their power accordingly. British forces discovered this early on the hard way when their attempts at breaching the reinforced palisades at Puketutu Pā during the Northern Campaign of 1845 against Honohiki. Hiki had realised the limitations of the British cannon, sighting his pā well in the interior where the heavier cannon could not be hauled, and then designing his palisades to stop the lighter shot. Most impressive, though, was how Māori integrated extensive earthworks into their defensive positions in a way that the British had only really otherwise seen in Europe. And I've got a few examples here. That picture, or that sketch, is from Rangiriri in 1863, where Māori fighting for the Kingitanga movement constructed an extensive defensive position consisting solely of earthworks with no palisading. Its very, very low profile confounded British and colonial attempts at reconnaissance and concealed the true strength of the position. You can see the size of the parapet there. The top of the parapet was between 4 and 6 metres above the base of that trench. A formidable obstacle to scale when surprised by it and without scaling ladders. British and colonial forces did eventually capture the position, but it was at the cost of almost 150 killed and wounded. The second one here is Oroko in 1864, where Riwi Maniapoto constructed defences that were more reminiscent of a traditional European fortress, with its bastions and its outworks. I think, though, perhaps the most impressive pā was Tauranga Ika, constructed by Titoko Whāru near Waiotautura, north of Whanganui. The pā was a masterpiece, consisting of mutually supporting bastions, trenches, and protected bunkers, double palisaded with firing loopholes. Perhaps fortunately for the colonial forces, it was abandoned without a fight, as Titoko Whāru's alliance began to resolve. Afterwards, it was regarded essentially as being almost impregnable. So why am I discussing these aspects of Māori warfare? Well, today the New Zealand Army has integrated aspects of this proud warrior tradition into our culture. It is as much a part of our military heritage as that shaped by the British and colonial forces that I'll be talking about today. In 1994, we became Ngāti Tumatauenga with our marae and wairu. Our ethos embodies elements of both warrior tradition through our Māori ancestors, and soldier tradition through our British and European ancestors. And that makes it something very unique to our New Zealand Army. But getting back to the main story. So, the Colonial Defence Force. The Colonial Defence Act of 1862 authorised the formation of New Zealand's very first regular force. The Colonial Defence Force was a mounted body of troops, not to exceed 500 men, with enrolment being voluntary for a 3-year period. Māori as well as Pākehā were eligible, and all officers and NCOs were appointed by the governor. Special forces were also created who specialised in bush fighting. They performed reconnaissance functions, acted as scouts, and protected Imperial troops' lines of communication. The first of these forces was raised in 1863 and known as the Taranaki Bushrangers, consisting of 50 men. The more famous force, however, were the Forest Rangers. Two companies of these were formed, one led by the renowned Major Gustavus von Temsky. And there he is, a Prussian adventurer with his trademark sabre, and what you can't quite see here on his right hip is his Bowie knife, which was standard issue for the Forest Rangers. Unfortunately, von Temsky came to a bit of a sticky end. He was killed in 1868 at the Battle of Tainutu Otemanu. The Armed Constabulary. So the Armed Constabulary Act was passed in 1867, and this force then superseded the Colonial Defence Force. The Armed Constabulary combined military with policing functions. At its strongest, there were 9 divisions, including 2 Māori divisions, each comprising between 60 and 80 men. Between 1868 and 1872, the Armed Constabulary undertook pursuit of Te Kōti, a noted Māori leader of the period. The force's other duties included patrolling and manning redoubts in the Waikato, Wairoa and Taranaki districts, as well as active campaigning, of course. The dual military police role was retained until 1886, when the force divided into 2 branches, the police and the field force or permanent force. You can see there actually that in that photograph, they're all wearing the very trademark shawl that was often worn by members of the Armed Constabulary during that period. Some parts of the constabulary specialised in irregular warfare, such as the Aroa flying columns led by Captain Gilbert Mair, who you can just see on the end there. And they fought in a way that was reminiscent of the Forest Rangers, leveraging their expertise in bush fighting and covering ground at a blistering pace to catch the enemy off guard. And they conducted extensive operations in the Uruwera in pursuit of Te Kōti. So I think at this point, it's appropriate to also acknowledge the other key influence for our army's development, and that is the British Army. British regular troops first arrived in New Zealand in 1840, a small detachment of the 80th Regiment from Sydney. Over the following 25 years, this grew and was sustained around the 1,000 to 2,000 mark, then rapidly growing as operations during the Waikato War peaked. By the end of 1865, there were about 10,000 British troops in New Zealand from 10 different regiments, as well as field artillery, Royal Engineers, naval detachments, and others. Outside of the Indian Army, this represented a significant proportion of the forces available to the British government for global expeditionary operations. It's fair to say that friction existed between the Imperial Government and the New Zealand Colonial Government, and this increased as time went on. London was critical of the colonial policies of land confiscation, and differences in opinion emerged regarding the conduct of operations. This led to the government developing a policy of self-reliance in 1864, which saw colonial forces taking over the lead for military operations in the country using the Colonial Defence Force and the Armed Constabulary, and the relatively swift withdrawal of British forces from 1866. The final British regiment, the 18th, withdrew from New Zealand in 1870. But the impact of the British Army on our military culture was profound and continues to this day. Our corps and regimental structures, our rank system, our approach to military discipline, all were inherited from the British. British soldiers pride themselves on their collective discipline and professionalism, and their steadfast and dogged determination in the face of the enemy, and so do we. Many British soldiers settled in New Zealand rather than returning to the UK, becoming an intrinsic part of our early society. So the image there are soldiers from the 65th Regiment, which is one of the stalwart units that served in New Zealand over the period of the land wars, all looking very dapper with their beards. So moving on to the period of the volunteers. So you'll recall that when the Militia Act was passed in 1858, it also made provision for the establishment of volunteer forces who could be required for service anywhere in New Zealand. These forces persisted beyond the end of the land wars, up until the Territorial Force was created in 1909. Volunteer units were formed on regional lines and included infantry, cavalry, engineers, and artillery. Each unit, or corps as it was known, consisted of 40 to 100 men, and overall in New Zealand there were approximately 6,000 volunteers during this period. There was also considerable variation between each of those different corps, including the uniforms that they wore. The main driver for volunteers after the land wars was a series of Russian scares, where it was feared that New Zealand was in imminent danger of invasion by Russian naval forces. This was the time of the great game between Russia, Great Britain, and other imperial powers. So volunteer corps most notably supported the fortification of the harbours at Auckland, Wellington, Lyttelton, and Dunedin. And those specific tasks were effectively how my own corps, the Royal New Zealand Engineers, started to come into being. And the image there is of the North Canterbury Volunteer Militia, taken in 1905. So that's the first segment. I'm now going to move on to talk about the period 1899 through to 1918. The image there being New Zealand soldiers in their trenches on the Somme. So the first campaign I'm going to talk about is South Africa, the Boer War, 1899 to 1902. New Zealand offered a contingent of mounted riflemen to the Imperial Government for operations against the Boer. And this was the very first time that New Zealand had contributed troops to military operations overseas. The first volunteer contingent of 214 officers and men was quickly mobilised in Wellington and dispatched with their horses in October 1899, arriving in Cape Town in late November. An unusual aspect of this mobilisation was that preference was given to men who could provide their own horses and who could pay for their own equipment. Over the course of the war, New Zealand provided 10 contingents totalling 6,500 men and about 8,000 horses. The term of enlistment was 12 months, but a number of men opted to stay on and then join later contingents in country. New Zealand forces were brigaded together with other forces rather than being employed operationally as a national entity. They took part in the initial conventional operations conducted against the Boer, and then also the subsequent counterinsurgency operations that were led by General Kitchener. New Zealand troops were highly regarded as mounted infantry, with some observing them to be the best mounted troops in South Africa. In all, 59 New Zealanders were killed during the war, killed in action, that is, with a further 229 dying of illness. And the image there is members of the 6th contingent conducting operations in the veld. World War One. So when the war broke out in August 1914, New Zealand was in a position and felt obliged to provide Great Britain an expeditionary force. At that time, because of the territorial force formation in 1909, there were already 30,000 men under training in the territorial force. They formed the basis of the volunteer force that provided the initial main body, along with reinforcements for a further 2-year period before New Zealand then had to start looking at conscription to meet its ongoing obligations. The war got off to a reasonably cruisy start for New Zealand with the capture of Samoa. On behalf of the British government, New Zealand sent a force of almost 1,500 men to occupy German Samoa, where they conducted an unopposed landing on the 29th of August 1914. And that photograph is literally them landing and stepping off the boat, so very much unopposed, as you can see. The main body, meanwhile, consisted of 4 battalions of infantry, 4 mounted rifle regiments, a field artillery brigade, and other ancillary arms. In total, almost 8,000 officers and men, as well as almost 4,000 horses. This represented the largest force that New Zealand had ever sent overseas. The force departed on the 14th of October 1914 under the command of Major General Godley. It arrived in Egypt in December 1914, and its first engagement occurred against Turkish troops in defence of the Suez Canal on the 2nd of February 1915. Probably the most famous campaign, however, is Gallipoli, which happened over the period April through December 1915. Our forces landed on the 25th of April as part of the Australian and New Zealand ANZAC Corps, where we fought alongside the Australians for the next 8 months in that desperate campaign against the Turks. So much has been written about Gallipoli, and I think it's safe to say that most New Zealanders know at least something about the campaign. I will just draw attention to one of the better known actions, which was the assault on Chunuk Bear. Chunuk Bear was a piece of key, if not decisive, terrain on the peninsula. In August 1915, it was seized by New Zealand troops, who then spent 3 days fighting off Turkish counterattacks before being relieved by the British, who were in turn forced to withdraw. To place the severity of fighting in context, of the 760 members of the Wellington Battalion who captured Chunuk Bear on the morning of the 8th of August, only 70 came out unwounded or slightly wounded. And their CO, Malone, was amongst the casualties. Between April and December 1915, 11,600 New Zealanders served on Gallipoli. 2,721 died on active service, while 4,752 were wounded. That's a casualty rate of almost 65%. Following their withdrawal from Gallipoli and further service in the Sinai Peninsula and Palestine, the New Zealand Division was ordered to France, where it arrived in April 1916. There they quickly became accustomed to the rigours of European trench warfare. So the image there is members of the Māori Pioneer Battalion, who were responsible for constructing trenches, road systems, as a supporting function, but within that frontline combat zone. The first major action fought by the New Zealanders was in the closing stages of the Somme offensive in September 1916. In 23 days of fighting, 1,560 New Zealanders were killed and a further 5,440 were wounded. The year 1917 brought depression, demoralisation, and frustration for the troops fighting on the Western Front. New Zealanders first took part in the Arras Offensive, which was mainly the New Zealand Tunnelling Company, who played a supporting role in preparing the way for part of the British assault that was launched in April. With the failure of the Nivelle Offensive, Field Marshal Haig then refocused his efforts in the area of Ypres. An important preliminary step to the major offensive that was due to occur was the removal of German forces from the Messines Ridge in the south of the area. And here, New Zealanders played a key part. General Godley's 2nd Anzac Corps would be the southernmost of a three-corps attack, with the New Zealand Division central in that corps and focused on the capture of the ruins of the Messines village itself. The attack was a striking and rare success on the Western Front. Launching early on the morning of the 7th of June, the division quickly captured its objectives and settled in for the expected German counterattacks. They were subjected to intense German artillery fire, and by the time the division was relieved on the 9th of June, it had suffered 3,700 casualties, including 700 killed. New Zealand's darkest day was, however, still to come during the subsequent Third Battle of Ypres. On the 12th of October, the New Zealand Division attacked Bellevue Spur, sustaining horrendous casualties. About 950 New Zealanders were killed on the 12th of October, or died of their wounds in the days that followed, and the overall casualty count was 2,700. It was, without a doubt, the costliest day for New Zealand in terms of lives lost in its post-1840 existence. New Zealand troops went on to help halt the German offensive in March 1918, and then also participated in the final British offensive of August 1918, which eventually led to the German capitulation. World War I was a watershed moment for New Zealand. Of the 100,000 New Zealanders that served in the war, around 17,000 were killed, with many, many more than that wounded. Considering the total population of the country was little over a million at that time, that was a staggering amount of loss. Never again would New Zealand allow its soldiers to be used by the Imperial Government without significant oversight and control. And the ghosts of World War I most definitely haunted a generation of senior leaders during the Second World War. And I still believe shape how we think about risk and casualty acceptance when it comes to military operations today. So what are the key takeaways from this period of history that have shaped our army of today? Well, for me, there's a few. As I mentioned, the corps and regimental structures that we inherited from our British ancestors are still extremely strong today. The regiment still forms the heart and the basis of our army. The integration of military heritage. So that fusion of Māori warrior ethos, along with the structure, collective discipline and dogged determination of our British ancestors. We continue to have a tradition of producing self-sufficient and resilient soldiers who are known to punch above their weight. Our people are known as being flexible and innovative, and this, still today, gives the New Zealand Army the ability to contribute to coalition operations in a really meaningful way, even though our contribution is often quite small in nature. The tradition of volunteerism that has been shown through our history with its strong territorial component continues to this day. TF battalions remain an important part of my brigade, 1st NZ Brigade, supporting and augmenting our regular force outputs. And lastly, I think for me, the strong sense of national identity and independence for us that followed the First World War, the level of national control that we exert over contingents we deploy as part of the coalitions, and the care taken to avoid exposing New Zealanders to unnecessary risk. I guess after the First World War, we stopped seeing ourselves as a part of the British Empire that served the British Empire, and started thinking more of ourselves as an independent nation with its own independent foreign policy. We've got a little bit of time if anyone would like to ask any questions.
Ian, do you know what the... I know that picture you showed of the Boer War, of the troops riding in to the north there. What did they have on their things, those long... They looked to be about 20 feet long. What were those?
Lances. Mounted rifles certainly had lances.
They weren't mounted troops.
They were.
So I knew somebody was going to ask this question when I saw that photograph. And I looked through as much as I could find, and it sounds like you're going to be able to answer this question for us. So
I think this is during the counterinsurgency phase, and they would be carrying materials to build bunkers.
That's what I thought. Yeah. My sense was that it was timber for constructing defensive positions. So what we call nowadays class 4 stores. But I searched for an explanation of that. I could find none. So
they used to they would build bunkers. Basically, they would seal off an area, and they would build bunkers in and around it about a mile. Gap in between, and they would supplement that with barbed wire and mobile forces, and then you would have a force that would sweep through that covered area to flush out any Boers.
Of course, a key part of Kitchener's strategy was separating the civilian population from the insurgents.
From which we get concentration camps.
Certainly, and I personally don't agree with Professor Belich's assessment. I think when you look at European history much earlier than the 1800s, the use of trenches, saps, was already very well developed, as was the construction of fortress-style earthworks and the like. And most recently, prior to the New Zealand Land Wars, you can look at the Napoleonic Wars operations in Spain and Portugal, the Lions of Torres Vedras. So I don't agree with him on that point, but what I think the Māori did show was an extraordinary ability to assess their enemy, to understand the impacts, the implications. They knew, they figured out how the British would fight, and then they adapted. And they adapted extremely successfully at the tactical level to defeat those British capabilities. Often the way these sieges played out, though, was the Māori would hold these defensive positions as the British forces would build their saps forward, working their cannon forward, and then there would be a point where it became untenable, and that was generally a point where they would withdraw from those positions. So That seems to be the case. It was less common for Māori to fight to the last man within their defensive positions. They would fight for as long as it was tenable, and then they would exit, and they would often cite their power to give good lines of withdrawal into close country or areas where it was more difficult for British colonial forces to pursue them. A couple of notable exceptions to that, where they made mistakes, the Battle of Oroco being a good example, where that didn't go so well for them with the pursuit.
I agree. If you go back in history, certainly we look at 1066, you know, with the Battle of Hastings, when Bishop John Dolphus was the first king's engineer. They employed trenching and sapping, you know, back in those times. And in fact, even go back even thousands of years into the Roman and Greek periods, they also used similar forms of trenching and sapping as we know today. But I think the other thing to reinforce what Ian was saying is out in our Engineer Corps Memorial Centre Library, we've got volume 17 of the Professional Papers of the Royal Engineers, and there's a report there by Major General Tom Mould, who was the Chief Royal Engineer in New Zealand. And his report to the British Parliament in 1869 covers the period from 1863 through till 1865. And in there are drawings, plan view, map view, scale drawings, of each of the battles from Rangiriri right through to, I think, Wairoa in Whanganui. And in each case, it shows how the Maori adapted from one battle to the next. Those that survived would go away, have a hui, worked out what went well, what didn't, against, you know, cannon, naval gunfire, musketry, small arms, and so on. And then they would come back in, and you can actually see the change in geometry over that 3-year period. It's quite fascinating to see how they changed the geometry and overhead cover, overhead projection.
And it was of great interest for the British too. I mean, they took that back to the School of Engineering at Chatham, where they experimented with how do we breach these palisades.
Right.
Because they were extremely difficult to get through with the weapon systems that the Brits had available. And of course the Māori sighted them so that the Brits couldn't haul their heavy cannon into location. So they knew what they were doing.
Oh yeah. I mean, Paparangi, that was 3.5 kilometres of hand-dug defences. And it was so strong that the British forces just couldn't penetrate the wall. And of course they had the bypass. Well, that was the very reason of putting it there. And I think there is some truth in during World War One, where the Allied forces looked at the way in which the Maori actually constructed a lot of their defensive positions and employed, or tried to employ, some of those principles on the Western Front. There's a lot of argument and debate about that, but I don't know. Peter, do you know anything about that argument?
As James Bellett certainly set things alive, I think he made the same, that Maori pretty much invented for themselves, then for trenched on warfare, and that's been taken away.
So it's an interesting topic.
Showing where Maori were part of the pioneer organisation, and no doubt they reflected a lot of the skills that their warriors had done. So I guess there is some of it.
The reason I raised the issue is that next year there's going to be a new history curriculum taught in schools. And if you look at what's on the website, it's a totally different approach to history as we knew it, or used to be facts and dates and stuff, nothing more.
No.
So it's very important to have this sort of presentation where the history as we understand it is confirmed. And not just a political or social input that people want to hear. It's got to be carved out.
Sure. And I'm not doing a bit of advertising here because I think we've only got 3 copies of the Engineer History left in the centre. But a very conscious decision that we made when we put that together a few years ago was that the first chapter actually describes the Māori as the original military engineer in New Zealand from the 1500s up until the early 1800s. And then the second chapter goes through a lot of the history that Ian's talking about, but specifically from an engineer perspective. But in that first chapter, it describes things like the power, the construction, the artillery power, the small arms power, a whole raft of different ranges of design of Maori fortifications. I mean, there were 7,500 of them throughout New Zealand, all hand dug. It's just incredible when you think about it. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. And we have actually made representation through Massey University to ensure that the history, the factual history, actually does get taught and not a lot of that mishmash that you were referring to.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Just one quick. What was your source for the 10,000 British in New Zealand?
I can't recall. It was, I think, one of the... There is a website that deals specifically with the history of the British Army in New Zealand.
Mm.
And I think that's where I drew that from. And they list the regiments as well.
Mm.
But that includes... That is a total number, including the naval detachments, all the other supporting corps as well, not just those infantry battalions. But I'd heard from other sources as well that at that time in New Zealand, even though the campaigning in New Zealand was seen by some as being a bit of a sideshow, it did soak up a considerable proportion of British fighting forces that were available to fight outside of India during that period. The British did not have a massive army at that point in their history. They tend to go through these periods of massive expansion and massive contraction, and during that time they were far smaller than what you would think.
Do you have a view to the contrary or otherwise? Or?
Oh, you have to look at what you looked at to comment.
Yeah.
Sorry. So,
No, I mean, it's interesting because sometimes it is difficult to find an authoritative source.
Mm.
But that wouldn't be far wrong. When you actually look at the number of units, particularly the British regiments and then the naval forces.
Are you talking cumulative or are you talking at one time?
No, that was peak.
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 Yeah.
During the Waikato campaign and General Cameron.
So you're talking at one time?
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? It is an interesting topic, and one of the reasons why. It's great to have Ian do the presentation because, apart from the significance of the history or the anniversary, it is part of our history, a very important part of our history that needs to be factually presented. Are there no other questions? Okay, look, I'll just take this opportunity on your behalf of thanking Ian very much for the time and effort that he's put into putting the presentation together. Just so that you're aware, Ian is not only the commanding officer of 2nd Engineer Regiment, he's also our regimental colonel for the engineers, but more particularly he also chairs the Linton Community Board and has just commanded the Central Task Unit that's been running off protect for the Central Region. So wearing all of these hats, it's quite an effort, and ask him to put a presentation together on top of that. Yeah, exactly. So, Ian, look, thanks very much for that. Ian's about to be posted overseas with his lovely wife, Tammy, here. So we wish them all the very, very best for their overseas posting. And Ian's going to take up a very important role where he's going to actually act as our corresponding member or liaison person with the Corps of Royal Engineers and re-establish those links in the UK. So, once again, Ian, thank you very, very much for the presentation.